Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You too. Bye-bye. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, the hardest-working, bravest people I know, crmw.net. John, Peter, ELO, Lottie, the News Ninjas, Susan and Jean, Texas Betsy, our blogger, Ben Birch, the hardest-working man in liberal talk. Thank you, all of you. And always, 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 RMR, Gina. It's all for you.
Kids, it's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 171 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively right here on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch at crmw.net. Please stop by crmw.net, Coal River Mountain Watch. See for yourself what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today being Thursday, July 31, the last day of July of 2008. So if you are listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on a Thursday evening, July 31, 2008, you are indeed listening to live programming, and you are welcome to phone in and participate, or participate via email or via chat with myself and the guest, whom I'll be introducing shortly. I'll tell you more about how to do that in just a moment. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and it is there that you're going to find links to all of the guest sites, and to the audio archives from past shows, as well as links to the chat room. There are also links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on this show. You'll also find there headonradionetwork.com, the main site of the network. That's headonradionetwork.com. And if you'll stop by headonradionetwork.com, you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which this program is a small part. Over at headonradionetwork.com, you'll also find the PayPal buttons that will make it easier for you to support the Head On Radio Network and the progressive liberal programming that we provide, and we appreciate your support. It is important to us that we receive that, and you have been faithful in doing so. Thank you for your support. The toll-free line, if you'd like to participate this evening, is 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366. That's toll-free to the studio in West Virginia if you'd like to join in. 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, you're welcome to use that. You could dial 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and that also rings at the studio in West Virginia, where Bob or Agnes will answer and cue you in to be on the show. The email arrives to peter@headonradionetwork.com. That's peter@headonradionetwork.com. And I do try to check the mail during the break. So you have several ways of participating with myself and the guest. That would be via email, peter@headonradionetwork.com, via the toll-free line or the toll line. Toll-free is 877-443-2366. Or simply stop into strictlyconfidentialradio.com, click on the chat room link. You'll be able to set yourself up with a chat name, and you'll fall right into the chat room, which I'm there, and some of our regular listeners are there also. You can participate by being in chat also. Last evening, on a Bob show, which is prior to this, the head-on show from 6 p.m. till 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and then on this show, Strictly Confidential Radio, it runs from 9 till 11. And then again, on the horn section, which runs from 11 until midnight, we discussed the Metropolitan Community Church in Knoxville, Tennessee. And if you recall, the reason that we were discussing the Metropolitan Community Church is because the reverend there wants to know the details of the letter that the fellow David Adkisson wrote. The David Adkisson, of course, being the man who committed the horrendous acts, the murders that took place at the Unitarian Church in Knoxville. We've talked about that at length for a couple of days now. The pastor is Bob Galloway. He'll be joining us shortly. Reverend Galloway says that he and his parishioners can't worship in peace until I know what's in the letter that David Adkisson wrote. Galloway says the more clarity, the better. We need to know what we're dealing with. Is it just liberals he's targeting? Is it just gays? Was it all these things mixed together? However, the Knoxville police chief has said that the police will not provide the letter or identify the shooter's targets. Those are targets, plural. And the police chief has said the four-page letter details his hatred of gays and the liberal movement, but the police will not reveal what's in that letter. The chief said to Reverend Galloway, as he made his request to know what was in it, if you need to know, you would have been notified. We all agreed, I think, on the programming yesterday evening that that was a high-handed remark from someone who it was not in the crosshairs of this man's weapon. Galloway said that answer is not good enough. He won't be satisfied until he reads the letter for himself. I do not blame him. You recall yesterday evening I told you a brief story about myself. I sometimes attend the Metropolitan Community Church in Tallahassee, and the Metropolitan Community Church in Tallahassee did until very recently, they have their own building now, but did until very recently use the facilities of the Unitarian Church in Tallahassee, and they were very gracious to provide space for the Metropolitan Community Church to meet at 6 p.m. in the evening. They provided the keys to the door, you could use the kitchen, you could use the sanctuary. They were very free and loving people. And that particular facility I have set during the services, and it's completely, almost completely glass. And one can look out into the woods as the sun sets during the afternoon at the 6 p.m. service. And I have thought to myself months and months ago, before any of this came up, I have sat in that church and thought to myself, what if someone were hiding out there in those woods with a shotgun? They could easily shoot through the glass windows and pick us off one by one. It is a shame. It is a shame that anyone in any church, that those thoughts would occur. And then over the last few days, and my worst nightmares have occurred in the shootings in Knoxville. So we will be talking to Bob Galloway, who will tell us about his congregation's reactions and about his interaction with the police chief, and we'll discuss that this evening. I want to just briefly read you the mission statement of the Metropolitan Community Church in Knoxville. I'll summarize it so that you'll have an understanding of the congregation that Bob Galloway represents. The mission statement reads, "We call people to a new life through the loving example of Jesus Christ to create a community of healing and reconciliation and to comfort injustice through Christian social action and liberation. Although we are a Christian church founded by lesbians and gay men, we are open to all, and we believe that God's grace transcends all boundaries of dogma, doctrine, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender, ability, and all forms of prejudice and bigotry. Among their ministries is a GLBT helpline, a children's ministry, a youth ministry, Potter's Group, which is young adults 18 to 30, a music ministry, and you've got to love this, Lesbians with Power Tools." Our friend Kate often jokes about having a chainsaw, so I'm sure she will, if she's listening this evening, which she very likely is, I'm sure she'll get a smile from that. They also have the Mike T. Irwin Food Pantry and the MCC Knoxville Social Network Group. One additional statement I will make from their mission statement is that, and I quote, "We provide a safe and affirming place, safe and affirming place for teaching, learning, and fostering community, for political action, evangelism, and involvement." And, of course, this safety has been shattered. So we won't delay any longer. Let's welcome Bob Galloway to the show. Bob, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Hello.
Good evening to you, sir. Thank you for being with us. Bob, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, if that changes, you let us know. The studio has lots of knobs and dials and bells and whistles. They can fix that right up. Bob, can you tell us about your first reaction when you heard the news about what happened at the Unitarian Church and where you were and your initial feelings?
Well, I was in the church office preparing for our worship service, which takes place at 11, when somebody came in and said they just heard the news and that the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Church had somebody walk in and shoot people. So then I tried searching the net to find information and kept running back and forth between our worship service and back to my computer to see if I could update people. Some people heard first that it was a gay-supportive church in West Knoxville. We were also in West Knoxville, and turned around and went home before they came to church. But we had about half the attendance we usually have because people heard about a shooting in a support gay church.
I see. So they thought it was your own church. They thought it was the MCC.
And we had a person that immediately tuned into a radio station, and she stayed outside for most of the service watching our property. And we are very lucky in that we only have one way that people can come and go. So she just took on herself to go out and protect that area.
Bob, what was...
We never saw the police, but the police said that they were sending to all of the churches that would be protected.
I see. And there was a no-show then?
Yeah.
Bob, what was the relationship of Metropolitan Community Church in Knoxville to the Unitarian Church?
When we started in 1977, we met for 8 years in their building. And since then, we've worked with them on environmental issues, on peace issues, on gay and lesbian issues. We've been working with a member of the church and the person who's responsible for Spectrum Cafe at the Tennessee Valley Church. Spectrum Cafe is the group for all youth, but with a particular emphasis on gay and lesbian youth and those in transgender and those that are affirming of them. And so we've worked with the different groups there and continue to have a strong relationship with them as we try to build some kind of network for youth citywide.
And so, Bob, when you heard this news, it immediately brought to you the memories of the exact location. You no doubt knew the inside of the building and the sanctuary very well, having having been there. Were you there the entire 8 years? Have you been the pastor there for that long?
When I came, it was in 85, and that's right after that we went to the United Church of Christ to meet. And for the last, I'm not sure, 5 or 6 years, they've been in a new building. This was their new building that was the one where the shooting took place.
I see. So, Bob, then you knew the people well then, and there were probably interpersonal relationships between others in your congregation and the people who attended the Universalist Church, the Unitarian Church.
Yeah, we're having our own debriefing after the worship service on Sunday because so many people are interconnected with the UU. We have some persons that rotate going to the UU church on one Sunday and coming to our church on the next. And everybody seems to have strong friendships with people at Tennessee Valley.
Bob, something that comes to my mind immediately, this individual's wife apparently attended that Unitarian church. Did you, in fact, have you or any of your parishioners met her? Did you know his ex-wife?
No. The name has not rung a bell at all on her.
I see. Nonetheless, I think that you would agree with me that it is very likely that this man, Atkinson, was aware of Metropolitan Community Church. Is that something that has been talked about, his awareness of the group, and how easily it could have been your church?
Yes, I think it could have been. I think that why he picked the Unitarians is that he knew their liberal viewpoint because of having been in their church, and it's hard not to enter that building without seeing the announcements for all of the gay activities that are going on in that building.
Bob, what is the general reaction of the parishioners of Metropolitan Community Church in Knoxville? Are some of the people talking about fear of attending at this point? Do you see yourself with a reduction of parishioners over the long term? I know some turned back when they heard the news on the radio. What is the general feeling?
I think mostly we're still in shock, but a number of people I've talked about have talked about their concerns about our security, and we feel we have none. And so there's a lot of people fearful, and anybody in East Tennessee knows that there's some good reasons for fear in this area, but I think we'll only see a reduction for a short time. And much like the arson that happened in our church back in the early 90s, we'll see out of this a growth because of people's commitment to stand with us.
Well, Bob, how was it that you came to speak with the police chief? Was this via telephone? Did he stop in?
I did not speak with the police chief. The police chief released that statement to the press. They would not release the letter, and everybody that needs to know knows.
I see.
He also said all of the churches that would be of concern were covered. And so, evidently, we don't need to know. And we're not of concern to any kind of violence against us. So.
Bob, how was that statement interpreted by you and the people that you know there? Were you offended by the tone of it?
Yeah, I think that it was offensive that everybody that needs to know knows, because I guess I'm such a strong believer that keeping secrets and keeping things secret develops the fear. The more out in the open we are, the more we can deal with our fears. And especially in a community that sees itself as being targets, we need to have some kind of openness and not feel that people in power are keeping secrets from us.
I see, Bob.
Bob, have members of the congregation come to you for grief counseling, or is that something that you're addressing, or do you have counselors who are already part of the congregation? Obviously, the LGBT community is very broad in nature, and you may very well have some psychologists or counselors already in attendance of the church.
We do have therapists, and they're going to lead our debriefing on Sunday, giving people a chance to speak, to hear the story, and to hear the stories of how people are reacting. So we're starting to deal with that.
One
of the things that I found is there's not been a lot of people who personally knew both persons that were killed. And most people don't know that others, since most of the persons that were injured in the shooting were not members of the UU, but rather were visitors that were there just for the play.
I see. And in terms of your outreach to the community, obviously the Unitarian Church, according to the news articles, was very, very open about its feelings of inclusiveness and published regarding the groups that met at the church. There's, I believe, it talked about the cafe that you just spoke about a little while ago and several other groups that met there. Is the Metropolitan Community Church as open? Are you also fairly visible in Knoxville? You are now, certainly, because of this news story. What? Tell us the overview there.
I think our visibility in the community is much less because our people are much more fearful. But at different times in our history, we've been very visible. And I think the last probably 3 or 4 years have been spent more in building community than outreach. And we just spent our whole visioning session since January. We've been talking about how do we move out again into the community and involve ourselves again to where we're very visible. Part of it is we've got a very invisible church building. We've been in this building that we now own for 10 years, and it's in the middle of the subdivision surrounded by woods, but you have to have directions to get to the church. So it's been, and I think that was rather intentional when they bought the building. I was not pastor at the time. It was rather intentional to have a place that they wanted to be and wanted to feel very safe. And so the Unitarian Church was right on one of the major roads in town. It was easily found.
Well, Bob, what I'm hearing you say is that, in fact, it was actually during last Sunday's service that you initially found out about this, and there was some running back and forth between our news reports and this. And so this coming Sunday, will this be the first time that you have met as a congregation since the tragedy?
Yeah. Well, we have an evening service, but that's only about 20 people.
I see.
So we have an evening service that night in which we did prayers for the church, the Unitarian Church, and also talked about how we respond because that was what the scripture readings were on, and talked about listening to each other. And I guess that's what concerns me also about the whole process is that if we don't know what we're dealing with, how do we listen? Nobody's speaking to us. How do we hear?
Yes. Bob, has the Metropolitan Community Church as a whole, I believe the headquarters are based in Los Angeles, or at least it used to be. Have there been comments to your congregation about what you should do or how to address the situation?
The moderator of the fellowship, Nancy Wilson, been in contact with us, and our regional elder and the regional team have been in contact. We talked about how do we respond, and right now we're just in a place of trying to reach out to our own people. And then I think that a number of the churches in town will be getting together to talk about how do we respond in a way that brings change.
I see. Well, Nancy Wilson has been a guest on this show. It's been almost a year ago, and she's a delightful and inspired person. Bob, tell us about the climate of the churches there in your area. Obviously, we read about and we talk about some of the mega churches who are very anti-gay and preach that message loudly from the pulpit. Are there churches in your area that, in fact, are known for preaching an anti-gay stance?
Yeah, there are some that, for the most part, it's been a very quiet climate for the last couple of years. And I think a great deal of that has been that the community has been much more visible with the marriage equality amendment in the state of Tennessee. When that was going on, everybody was very vocal. And I think that the persons in the more fundamentalist churches sort of think the fight's over since they won that amendment fight. And so they really settled down into a quiet. I expect that there will be voices raised that are very strange voices to hear in the midst of the trauma. They won't be raised until after things quiet down.
Yes.
But we are surrounded by a lot of very conservative churches. But for the most part, in the city of Knoxville, there seems to be a lot of middle-of-the-road churches that are not speaking at all.
I see. And I expect then that this will put some pressure on the middle-of-the-road churches to take a stand on this sort of thing. A church doesn't get attacked in any community, regardless of its faith, without it causing people to examine their stand. Do you think that something good could possibly come out of this?
Yeah. I felt great hope at the memorial service on Monday night, because there was so many different faith communities represented there. And I think that that's the start of something good coming out of it, that people are ready to say that it's time that we respect each other, no matter if we agree or not. And I think that's a big step forward for us.
I see. Has there been discussion that you're aware of as to the reasons that the police are attempting to suppress this letter? Obviously, there's the whole thing about using it as evidence, yet in this particular situation, there is so much other evidence than the letter. There are the countless number of witnesses, let's just say it's pretty much open and shut, even without the letter. Has there been some discussion about the letter being held in confidence and some general feelings about that?
Most of it seems to be evidentiary, that it's going to be used as evidence and can't be disclosed. The police chief to the media has said that it'll be up to the DA now to evaluate when to reveal it any time before the trial. And so, in essence, I think the police chief has handed it off so that he doesn't have to deal with it and sees it as a political issue. So, and I think that's what we're worried about, is that it's just a political issue.
I see. And by hand it off, do you mean to the federal, to the feds?
No, to our district attorney here, the attorney general for Knox County.
I see.
The charges for the murders. Well, has already charged with one murder and filing the other charge now.
Because there's not a hate crimes law that I'm aware of anyway in the state of Tennessee. Do you know obviously it was an attack, but do you know how the crime will be characterized because of the lack of a hate crimes law in that state?
It can be characterized in the state of Tennessee as a hate crime, and I think that it probably will be, but it doesn't make much difference to us in Tennessee because all the hate crime legislation does in Tennessee is can add up to 12 years to a sentence, and since they're going to try this as a capital offense, it's either a life sentence or death, and so it doesn't do any good to add anything on to either of those.
Bob, what do you know about the man himself, this Atkinson? The general portrayal that we're getting in the press is that he acted alone, probably under the influence of the Sean Hannitys and the Savages and the O'Reillys. It's my understanding he actually had those books with him in his vehicle. Is there a general feeling that he acted alone, or is he part of some sort of a group?
I think the general feeling is that he acted alone, and he seems to have been very much a loner, and from what I can understand, a person who in any way have looked at his personality profile type stuff is not a person that would be a strong group person at all. He's been very much alone for most of the time that he's been, has spent in Powell, because the neighbors there have talked about him being very much a loner, being friendly to them, and being a loner.
I see. We also talked about last evening about the crime and talking about your church and the police statement. We talked about how economic conditions aggravate this sort of thing. There was news that his food stamps had been cut, and obviously when people are in crisis or in turmoil, there is a tendency for us to lash out and to blame someone. In his case, I would assume motivated by all of the hate speech that he no doubt tunes into those programs of the folks that whose books he had with him. So one would assume he has a healthy dose of hate speech. So obviously he turned upon the liberals and the gays, which tend to be the scapegoats of those people and that mindset. What is the economic situation like in Knoxville? Is it getting fairly grim? Do you expect more? Of course, you can never expect this. It comes out of the clear blue. But what, in general, is the economic situation there?
Well, in general, we're not as bad as the nation in unemployment. Most people can find jobs. We've never been a well-paid area of the country, but we're also a fairly cheap cost of living. So I'm not sure that it's as much economic as it was his own abilities to operate within the system. His bouts of drunkenness, which are described by his ex-wife, and the divorce papers, and she describes him as daily being drunk. I think that we see here a person who has a very difficult time participating in systems. And one of the problems with the economic, the food stamps and stuff, is that we have no places for people that have problems with systems to learn how to deal with the systems. They just pass through them. And I don't see that he got any help with how do you find employment. I don't see that he got, I don't see that anybody right now. I'm not sure how it is around the country, but I know that I just got a call today from a person who said that just because they make they have thousands of dollars in medical bills to pay. And so I can see the frustration of this person's call, who's doing quite well and knows how to use the systems. And a person that just doesn't know how is lost in our society.
Yes. And to be sure, the agencies that provide food stamps and assistance, be it county or state level, they are, in fact, their goal is to deny you services because their services are so, in other words, if there's any possible way to deny services or cut services, that would be their goal rather than to at least this is the slant that I get from people on the inside who have worked in these service agencies from the county and the state. So there's obviously no friendly ear there
right.
for people to turn to. Bob, what are the demographics of your church? Years ago, Metropolitan Community Church had men and women, but I understand, and I've seen it in the Tallahassee Church, many families are coming. Same-sex partners will bring children and their grandparents or their mom. What are the demographics of your church?
Probably between 80 to 85% of our church is gay or lesbian, and about 50-50 between women and men. We have probably close to 3% that are transgender. We have a number of persons that are heterosexual men. Just 4 years ago, we had the request, or 5 years ago, I guess it was, we had the request to start a children's ministry and had to end up buying an annex building to have room for all the children. We get sometimes up to 22 children. And so we're seeing a lot more families and a lot more adoptions than foster care families. And I just think that if people would come and see the parenting skills of these parents, it would help so much for them to know what great parents we got in this congregation. And one of the persons killed was, Greg was just started foster care for a gay teen. So,
I think we may have talked about her last evening. She was in the play, or he was in the play?
Yeah, he was in the play.
Yes. And saw his father, his adoptive parent, killed.
Yes.
There in the... I have a question. It's tragic. My heart goes out to you. I have a question for you from the chat room. You may have heard at the beginning of the show, we have the toll-free lines. We have the chat room, too. One of the chatters is asking, would like me to ask you if the ACLU is helping you or is offered to help you get access to the letter by the Freedom of Information Act. Has anything like that happened at this point?
No, we've not been contacted by anybody. And at this point, we've not reached out to anybody for assistance.
At this point, certainly the wounds are deep and probably difficult to even focus on those things. Has the police department had, other than this one statement about if you needed to know, what is their general, have they made an address or have they addressed the community at large via newspaper or any other way? Have representatives from the police department been on the local television to talk about this? What's happening in that respect?
Well, they have had a couple of press conferences in which all the media attended and have addressed parts of the letter. The problem is it's the two press conferences, they use different words, and so it was hard to tell if they're just giving general impressions or if they're quoting from the letter. But so they've released what they think is necessary for the community.
I see. The initial reaction, which is usually the case, Bob, amongst that are extreme right. There are many blogs on the internet that we follow where people who are, we call them freepers, typically people on the far right who are, there seems to be a great need for them to sort of sweep this under the table. There are remarks about them. That we don't need to stir this garbage up anymore, and that the liberals are going to, or the reason this is becoming a big issue is that the liberals and the gays are bringing it up as a political statement. Then on the other side of that, if the man who had shot up the church had been a Muslim with a turban, he would have been declared a terrorist immediately, and the national media would have been all over it. Nonetheless, it's our feeling here that he did act in a terrorist manner, being almost in a Tim McVeigh sort of way. Has there been any discussion with your people about calling this a terrorist act rather than to call it a hate crime?
No, there really hasn't. And I'm not sure exactly why, because we were so quick to call Columbine and Oklahoma City, all of the other places, the church that was invaded by one of their former members, all of those kinds of things were much more talked about as terrorist acts. And I think that part of why it's not talked about a terrorist act here is that the Unitarians themselves have responded so loving, caring, and forgiving that here in Knoxville, I had a person quote to me, I wish Christian churches would respond as Christ-like as the Unitarians did.
It's a shame. That is a shame, Bob. Well, certainly releasing the letter would help the public to understand what's going on and what to look for in other potential situations, and perhaps stop future incidents like this, at least in your area. I hope that letter is released. Do you have plans? I realize you're overwhelmed, and all of this is very fresh. The wound is fresh. But do you have plans regarding pursuing that, or is that something that you'll look at later?
Well, we're going to be looking at that later, but I think that we are pursuing it right now, and I think that we'll try to set up a time to meet with Chief Sterling Owens and see if we can talk about it. One of the things is we're a block from the city limits. We're in the county.
I see. Yes, that does people may not realize. I live in the county, too, not in the city of Tallahassee, and that's the whole different color there. That's a different horse of a different color when you move to the county.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, one last question, and first of all, thank you so much for sharing with us at a time like this. I know it's difficult, but the last question regarding O'Reilly and Savage and Hannity and that type of the hate talkers who make millions of dollars doing it. Have there been any discussions amongst your people laying any responsibility at their feet? Because all three of them have been deathly silence on this issue. I don't think they want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Well, I think so far I'm the only one that's brought it up. And my thing is, one of the things that we're going to change is we have to look at holding media outlets accountable for what their people say. And it sounds like trying to rein in free speech, but that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make free speech respected speech also. And,
amen.
With so many people feeling left out, the anger is so easy to stir. And we just need to watch our speech so that we're not stirring up the anger. And since I don't really spend any time listening to those people, I happened to hit Michael Savage once when I was going home from work, and I just was amazed at the hatred and the outright calling people to kill people. And that was the only time I listened to the show, but you know, we just ought to take our guns and shoot these people. And that just upset me greatly. So I can't listen to them because it makes me angry, and I think that's the whole revolution and evolution of anger has got to stop, and we've got to start being able to listen and respect each other. And as long as people are making money from it, they're not going to stop. And I think that's where the news outlets have to stop. I just, for the first time, got cable and found that what supposedly news shows are not news shows, but rather commentary all day. And you know, I would really like to have news.
Well, I completely agree with you, and I sympathize with you so much. You know, in doing a show like this and the other hosts on this network, we are constantly immersed in what I'd like to call the cesspool of the for-profit media. That's what we call them, for-profit news or for-profit media. And if anything possibly good could come of this, I would hope that there is a discussion of reining in free hate speech. The combined Second Amendment and millions of dollars and people who are willing to say anything for a buck is a deadly combination.
Yes.
And Bob, I want to thank you for joining us this evening. I've asked you a number of questions, and I don't want to let you go without just opening up to you. There may be comments that you would like to make that I haven't. That I haven't asked about or that we haven't addressed. Is there something that you could say to us about this horrible thing that's happened in Knoxville?
Looking at the response so far, I have great hope that this is going to be the change, particularly as I look at the youth group at the Unitarian Church who have responded with such great dignity. Care for one another and care for the church and care for the wider community. And I think that the rest of us have to learn from these youth what it is that makes for peace. And they're going to be our teachers.
Well, thank you, Bob Galloway, and God bless you and your congregation and what you're going through. Please know that this network is always here for you. If you need to, if there's something you would like to say at large, please feel free to phone into this show, or in fact, any of the other shows, to be perfectly honest with you. Any of them would be more than happy to bring you on without any sort of guest arrangements and let you have free reign over what you'd like to say. So we please consider us an ally.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good evening. Good evening, Mr. Galloway. That was tough. Obviously, the wounds are deep, and I can certainly understand that, having met in that very church for 8 years, the wounds are very deep. You could hear it in his voice, and no doubt these wounds are just as deep within the congregation. And it sort of puts a personal face on the things we've been talking about. All of these things, all of these incidents that are happening to people, losing jobs, having to decide between gas in the car to go to work or to fill your prescription. All of the things that are happening in this country have a face. It's a very personal face. And I'm glad that we were able to look at one this evening. Well, we've run on now for almost 50 minutes, so we'll take a short break. This is Peter Godbold. You're listening to Strictly Confidential, a part of the Head On Radio Network, and we'll be back. Thank you.
Riding across America on a horse named Strictly Confidential, a man who knows his way around a pair of chaps. Here's your host, Peter Godbold.
And indeed, I am back. This is Peter Godbold, Strictly Confidential, and you're listening to the Head On Radio Network, progressive radio like you've never heard it before. You know, and thinking about the comments that Bob made, This thing about the constant hate speech from the far right and the constant blaming of the liberals for everything that is wrong in society and the constant references to the homosexuals stealing children and even we played audio a while back about, I think it was Savage saying that the lesbians had pink pistols and they were kidnapping little girls, and there's no one to challenge this except progressive radio, and of course these people are not listening to this progressive radio or any of the other progressive outlets. They're listening only to the hate speech, which arrives 24/7 in an endless stream, as Bob pointed out in his conversation with us, that he had recently gotten cable and he was shocked to find out that it's a constant stream of commentary, and I can only add to that right-wing commentary. One wonders just where in the hell people thought that this dam was going to burst. Obviously, everyone knows that the LGBT community is attacked in general daily on more of an individual basis. I have a stack of stories right now of gay folks walking out of bars, gay folks walking out of restaurants who are attacked and beaten. These are in this country and in others. This is a daily diet. But one wonders where people thought this was going to blow up. Did we think that they were going to bomb the Democratic National Convention, the committee coming up in November? And when you think about it, where else would a congregation or a group of progressives / liberal / homosexuals / lesbians, transgendered, where else would you find them but a metropolitan community church or a Unitarian church? Where else? Certainly not in the Methodist church. Certainly not in the Baptist church. So it hit the fan, and the right-wing talking bastards need to be held accountable. But will they? I would venture to say no, not as long as the for-profit media is spinning in this direction. No, it takes the media to make an issue of anything. Otherwise, it goes down the 24-hour memory hole. The issue vanishes. And in 3 weeks, no one will know, no one will remember this. And Michael Savage and Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and the others
will continue unabated. There will be no discussion to rein it in. There will be no discussion of equal time. You can be damn sure that Nancy Pelosi wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. It would just be too controversial, you see. So I share in his grief and his concern, and because I have felt the fear firsthand, and when this happened, it affected me in a very personal way, because it was as if my worst nightmare happened. I could easily visualize the blood on the shirts and the people running and the kids in the play and the smell of the sulfur, as one of the women described it. Carla, I read her personal account last evening. She thought it was stage props or maybe a speaker blew up. She didn't know there was a production going on until she smelled the sulfur. So where does it end? Where is it going to end? Well, let's move on if we can. An interesting article from London. They have, located a gene that is the gene behind female-to-male transsexuality. Who knew? The report from July 30 in London says that women who are not comfortable in their skins and believe that they belong to the opposite sex should blame the feeling on a gene variant, scientists are saying at the Medical University of Vienna in Austria. This report is from London, but the university is in Austria. Of course, the behavior is complex, and it mainly attributed to multiple genes and environment and cultural factors, etc., etc. But researchers claim that this gene may be responsible for female-to-male transsexuality. And the researchers have found that the variation occurs in the gene for an enzyme called cytochrome P17. I may not be pronouncing that correctly. We have a nuclear physicist, so to speak, in the chat room. I'm sure I'll be screaming that I'm not pronouncing it correctly, but that's as close as I can come. And that particular enzyme is involved in the metabolism of sex hormones. They went on to say that the presence of this variant causes higher than average tissue concentrations of male and female sex hormones, which in turn affects early brain development, which we've discussed on the show before regarding various genes that they're finding these days, which have to do with orientation and the wiring of the brain. The variant was discovered by a team when they examined samples from 49 FTM, which is female to male, 102 male to female transsexuals, as well as almost 2,000 non-transsexuals as a control group. The variant was found to be more common in men than in women. However, it doesn't seem to be implicated in male-to-female transsexuality, as the proportion of male-to-female transsexuals with it was similar to that in non-transsexual men. However, in women, they did encounter differences in 44% of the female-to-male transsexuals. They carried it against 31% of the non-transsexual women. Oh, it's always such a ride to explain these things. It's the sort of thing that even if you had a copy in your head, you'd have to read it twice. In any case, they go on to say the many women with the variant who are not transsexual and many female-to-male transsexuals who lack it, there are many of them, and the results indicate the variant makes women more likely to feel their bodies are of the wrong sex. Findings also raise the possibility that as a result of the brains having been exposed to higher than average levels of sex hormones during development due to the higher rate of metabolism that this enzyme causes. Yeah, I'm glad I got that out. We have a caller on the line. Sue, welcome to the show.
Hello, Peter, you sweetheart, you.
Sue, you old sweetie, it's so good to talk to you on this show.
Well, you know, I was going to call you the other night, and it was like, no, don't don't, you know, try, you know, now that we've had a couple of days to let a scab kind of form a little bit, that it was, Bob had me working on a project and I needed some images. So I went to Google Images and typed in liberal and just hit search. And
yes.
I was just, oh, I was floored. There was, you know, it's like Pastor Bob was talking about how once he got cable television, he was amazed at how readily available right-wing hate speech is.
Yes.
I was just floored by the number of page after page after page of hating liberal images I got. And
Sue, this never occurred to me. I use Google Images image searches a lot, and I've never typed that. It just never occurred to me that in addition to the hate speech, there's the cartoons and the various images. Just never occurred to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's you know, just type in liberals and do an image search, and then type in Republicans and do an image search, because the difference is, I mean, you know, when you typed in liberals, I got things from that ran the gamut, things that I'm not going to repeat here on your program, to things of hey liberals, if you can't stand behind our troops and do us a favor and stand in front of them. And there's a soldier, a shadow, a silhouette of a soldier with a gun, a sniper gun, you know, ready to shoot. You know, they want us dead, and the shooting. But the difference is, if you do an image search for liberals and one for Republicans, I had to go probably 12 pages before I got into images that were more pro-liberal.
I'll be darned, Sue. Yeah, I had no idea.
When I typed in Republican and hit search, I mean, you know, immediately there were, you know, pictures of, you know, the shrub.
Let me guess. And flags and puppies and
apple pie.
Yeah, no doubt.
And the whole nine yards, and it's like, you know, had I known, you know, What kind of world do they have to live in to be so goddamn mean? They're just mean.
It's true, Sue, and you know as well as I that the only way to ever get rid of us would be to kill us. So none of us are going away, and they seem to be perfectly willing to make that leap. The ones who are afraid to actually do the killing certainly are not afraid to do the encouraging. You know, other countries have hate speech laws, and people are charged with hate speech crimes, and it's only if the speech rises to incitement, to the level of incitement. And I often see news articles on the Pink News, which is out of the United Kingdom, regarding people who have been charged for hate speech because their speech rises to the level of incitement. And, you know, one can just imagine if that sort of a law were ever even just briefly mentioned inside the chambers, the cries from all of the fundies and the right wingers would in one fell swoop deafen us all.
Right.
One would expect.
They have just gotten so far afield. I mean, we knew that there had to be something fundamentally wrong with them to begin with, and obviously there is. When that study was released last year that had followed this young group of kids for 20 years, from the time they were preschoolers to young adulthood, obviously old enough, you know, to be in college and things like that. So it wasn't a 5-year study. This was a generational study, and it showed that the ones that were whiny grew up to be Republican. And that's not an issue of nature or nurture. You're born that way.
It's a fundamental character flaw. Oh, it is. And they have a very hard time dealing with it, don't they? It's the fear of anything different from what they've always known. It's some sort of phobia. It's liberal phobia, homophobia. What is it? I don't even have a word.
You know, I think Rick Goodman needs like a marathon, a psycho marathon or something to help us kind of sort these things out, because they're dangerous now. I just can't get, you know, and I'm not being polite to them anymore, and maybe I should be, because, you know, they expect, you know, I'm a liberal. We're liberals. We're not doormats. And the next, you know, if you ever get into a heated discussion with a diehard neocon, you know, and they get their dander up, and after 5 minutes of them yelling at you, you raise your voice back, "Oh, you're supposed to be a peacenik and hug a tree," and it's like, you know, well, if you think I'm going to be abused by you, you can kiss my butt.
You know, that was an aspect of the shooting in Knoxville. He went in that church, and he apparently in his document that he did not expect to come out. He had plenty of ammunition. He was going to shoot everyone, and he fully expected to be killed by the police. And we're talking about it the other evening. I think he was shocked to find that progressive or liberal men immediately stood up to protect their own. Progressives with balls, I think, is something they have a really hard time understanding. And he was immediately tackled and taken down to the floor. So that had to be a huge shock for him that we were not as easy as we were not as described.
Well, and that's exactly why his mugshot has that look on his face of, what the hell just happened? Well, it's the same thing that leads John Boehner to cry on the floor of the House when he doesn't think the troops are going to get enough money so they can stay over there and kill brown people. There he is, crying on the floor of the House. You know, they're babies. God, they just make me nutters. But I couldn't let another day pass without letting you know that you know, just do a search one, do one for liberals, and then do one for, and I think you'll be horribly, probably not shocked, but just horribly. It's horrifying.
No doubt.
It really is.
No doubt I will. I intentionally have not typed that into Google while we were talking for fear of what I might see. And I'm going to save that for later, maybe even over the weekend, so I can scream real loud and Doggy will run into the dresser. But, you know, I just didn't know that, Sue. That catches me completely off guard. But it makes perfect sense when you.
Yeah, it totally caught me off guard too. I was just really shocked, and it was I was working on this project while Bob was on air, and then it went on in your show too, and I was working on it, and with you both talking about it, you know, that I just kept going, God, and I'd go back and search it again, and look and see if it had changed. You know, it's like I've got to be doing something wrong. And sure enough, it wasn't. And I was just horrified. And then after listening to your guest tonight, it's like, you know, it's not just cable TV. It is everywhere. The liberals have taken over the internet. You can't tell it by Google.
Yeah, you sure as hell can't tell that from Google. That's the shame. I'll definitely do that,
Katie,
too.
I'll let you get back to your show and that, but I just wanted to call and fill you in on that. So
thank
keep
you.
Up the good work, and I love you.
Thank you. I love you, too, and thank you for calling in. That's Sue, and Sue is one of our chat moderators, as a matter of fact. She is very important in this thing that we call the Head-On Radio Network. She is an important part of it, as are the News Ninjas and the other moderators. Bob and I have talked, and on our shows individually and together, the almost miraculous nature of the talents of the individuals that have fallen into place to do this. I think we, in fact, are an example of a network with talent on loan from God, as opposed to the fat ass, barbiturate sucking talking head that we love so well. It's been a heavy, heavy news evening. Let's cover something a little bit lighter. I came across this regarding lovely parting gifts. And as you may know, or as you may not know, recently it's been announced that the Game Show Network is relaunching, wait for it, hold your breath, the Newlywed Game. Oh, my God. And as you may or may not know, same-sex couples are currently marrying in two of our nation's states. I think anyone who listens to this network would know that. They're obtaining civil unions in four more states. So that means, of course, that the newlywedded gays and lesbian couples will be totally, like, eligible for the revised version of the 70s-era game show called Newlywed Game. Well, actually, no. The rules for the Newlywed Game, the rules and requirements as outlined by the network, each newlywed team of contestants must be legally married to each other, paren, legal marriage defined as one that is legally valid in all 50 states of the United States, it goes on to say. Other things about proof of marriage, but I just thought I would let you know that there will be no LGBT folks on the Newlywed Game, regardless of how clever and catty their remarks might be, and as entertaining as that might be. We're going to get just men and women on the Newlywed Game. And then there's a follow-up report that actually the Newlywed Game may actually have some LGBT component to it. And that is because an out lesbian, her name is Judy Gold, is serving as the host of the Newlywed Game. And the deal is that her orientation, she often peppers that into her regular routines. And we know that she's not going to be shying away about her own relationship. She has never done that in the past. Certainly she won't be doing it on this show. So one wonders what her thoughts about the heterosexuals only Newlywed Game. Just another small piece of the let's all pretend we're normal facade that the networks like to put on for us. And in the some LGBT folks are bad people column, it's been reported that one of the 9/11 cons has been hiding in plain sight. He is an up-and-coming internet gossip blogger in L.A., and he has also been outed as a fugitive scam artist who ripped off charities with phony tales of a lover killed on 9/11. Now, the site, I believe, is called Boys About Town. His name is Patrick Henn. He's 33. He was once a regular in the West Coast establishments, the red carpet places, opening nights, the standard drill. He was picked up on parole violations stemming from a 2005 fraud conviction in Florida, and he fled to California. He served nearly 2 years in prison in Florida. And then he skipped out after getting out of prison. He was placed on 12 years of probation. So after being placed on 12 years of probation, he skipped Florida and reinvented himself in Long Beach, California, as a celebrity hound. Yes, indeed. He's been called a flamboyant. I'm sure that's the least of it. He stole about $68,000 in cash and benefits from the Red Cross. And the general thought of, for instance, Empire State Pride is the New York gay rights group. They have said, and I completely agree, that anyone who would use the tragedy of 9/11 to benefit themselves financially is disgusting. I'm glad he went off to prison the first time. It appears he's headed back there again. So just let you know that not all of the scammers following Katrina, I'm sure, who pretended to have addresses and homes that were destroyed, and not all of the scammers for 9/11 were straight folks. Some of them lost lovers, you see, in 9/11. And we have to be fair and share the dirt along with the rest of the story. Let's see. Interesting piece here. This actually came up several days ago, but at the time I didn't present it to you simply because it was so complicated. It was far worse than the story I just told you about the trans gene with the enzyme names and all that. There's a simplified version in language that I could actually pronounce, or at least we'll try to. Doctors may have found a way to actually not reduce the progress of HIV or to prolong life, but actually found a way perhaps to destroy HIV. Now, this is from Houston, and there's real hope in a Houston lab that they have found a cure for HIV. And what it amounts to is they found a new way to kill the virus by finding a very small region of the HIV virus that is unchangeable. And this is what the University of Texas Medical School Dr. Paul says. You see, one of the reasons that HIV is so difficult to treat is because it's constantly morphing into new forms of the virus. All the forms do the same thing, but no one medicine will continue to work. It can only suppress it because the virus morphs to avoid anything that hurts the virus. It's probably just about the cleverest virus that has ever hit the planet. Nonetheless, it has been impossible to find any way to kill the virus simply because the virus is constantly changing. There's nothing that kills virus without killing you, too. In any case, at this point, though, they're not talking about suppressing HIV. They're talking about destroying it permanently by arming the immune system with a new weapon that they have found to be effective. Now, one of the folks in the lab has been HIV positive for 15 years. He's on a powerful drug cocktail that keeps the disease in check, which I am on a powerful drug cocktail, too. And I have to tell you, living longer is really nice, but the side effects from these powerful drug cocktails will knock you right out. Lord have mercy. You can't imagine the fatigue and nausea and general feeling of malaise. And it just goes on and on. But, you know, hey, it's a small price to pay for keeping the lights on, is it not? But the powerful drug cocktails are not without their effects. He says, I'm on four different medications. Three of them are brand new. And it's the first time I've ever been non-detectable. You see, these cocktails are able to suppress the virus to a level that it's not the, you can't find it in blood tests. There's so many, they have to be, has to be a minimum count of the virus in every, liter of blood or picoliter, however they do it. In any case, if it goes below a certain level, it's called non-detectable. They're not saying that it isn't there, it's just that there's not enough there for them to find them, and you're in great shape if you're non-detectable. He says, I'm down right now to about 9 pills per day, 5 in the morning and 4 at night. That sounds about like the ones that I take. But the thing is that HIV mutates, and it will outsmart the medications eventually, which is why it's so important that the new medications are released time after time after time, and just in time, usually to catch the next phase of the virus's mutation. By the way, you know, sometimes, you know, it's, I don't mean to complain. You know, having HIV is actually, if you're going to have a serious illness, it's a blessing to have HIV, and I'll tell you why. HIV is, generally speaking, although certainly things could be done regarding funding and prevention, generally speaking, what I would call a popular illness. In other words, it's talked about, there's research done, and there are medications for it, whereas so many other illnesses, which are very serious and are life-threatening, are not, quote, popular diseases. What would that list be? There's a connective tissue disorder. There are various lung conditions. Sarcoidosis, I think, is one. That these things are not reversible, and there's no treatment for them. And they're not very popular, you see, because a lot of people don't have them. So it's not talked about. So if you're going to have a major life-threatening illness, I would think that HIV is the one you would want to have because it's actually being researched. And sometimes I feel very badly for those who are very ill and have a hard time functioning and eventually, of course, threaten face end of life scenarios because their disease is not popular. In any case, getting back to HIV, the virus is very complex, has many tricks, but the doctors in Houston feel that they have cracked the code. They have discovered the weak spot of HIV. You see, on the surface of HIV, this surface that constantly changes and mutates, there has to be at least one portion of that surface that does not change. If that portion were not there, then in fact HIV couldn't exist. I couldn't tell you why. I'm sure someone in our chat room could. But in any case, there has to be some segment of the protein on the HIV structure that does not mutate. This is true of any virus. And the thing is that they believe that at this point they have finally found it. And the virus needs at least one constant region, and they're calling it the Achilles heel of the HIV virus. And then we get into the names of enzymes, and that some of these enzymes can permanently disarm the HIV virus. And so in any case, the idea is that it could be used to control the disease, if not eliminate the virus altogether from those who already have it, and prevent infection from those at risk. And the theory so far is held up in lab and animal testing. The next step is human trials. Meanwhile, every day in Houston, 3 people are diagnosed with HIV. And clinical trials are very expensive. And they probably won't know for another 5 years. But, there have been breakthroughs before. One never gets one's hopes up. And it has been said that once an individual's immune system has been compromised down to the point where it's almost non-existent, that it basically never recovers, whether the HIV is there or not. Whether the virus is there or not, the immune system does not bounce back when it's been beaten down all the way to the ground. Nonetheless, it would certainly be nice to have the virus eliminated. And by the way, I want to talk to you a minute about the Black AIDS Institute report. They have found that AIDS in segments of the black community in America is as severe as in many African countries, but receives much less attention. This article is regarding the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And the United States leads a global response to the HIV/AIDS crisis, but fails to mobilize the same commitment to address the large and growing epidemic within its own borders. Now, this is a report that was released just the other day by the Black AIDS Institute. The full name of the report is Left Behind: Black America, a Neglected Priority in the Global AIDS Epidemic. It praises the United States for its efforts to address HIV worldwide, but criticizes the government's profoundly inadequate response to the epidemic within its own borders, where black Americans are most severely affected by the disease. More black Americans are infected with HIV than the total population of people living with HIV in 7 of the 15 countries that are served by the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. Were the black people in this country a separate country? Were all of the black people in this country a separate country? It would elicit major concern and extensive assistance from the United States government. However, because the black people in this country are not part of a separate country, the response to AIDS among black Americans has been lethargic, neglectful, and you can pretty much pick out your own descriptive word there. The report illustrates a very clear and startling gap between the U.S. government's concern for AIDS overseas and the ongoing denial of the epidemic at home. The facts are that in areas such as Detroit, Newark, New York, Washington, D.C., the Deep South, as in Dixie, HIV among segments of the black community approaches those of many of these severely affected countries. In Africa, for example, HIV prevalence amongst middle-aged black men in Manhattan is almost as high as the overall prevalence in South Africa, which is, of course, home to the largest population of people living with HIV. The report also points out that the U.S. government requires country receiving AIDS support from the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. Countries that receive that support are required to have a national AIDS strategy in place, period, or you don't get the funding. Well, guess what? The United States itself has absolutely no strategy for its own epidemic and was one of 40 countries that completely failed to fulfill its commitments to report to the joint United Nations program on HIV and AIDS. I guess someone in the Bush administration just couldn't quite get around to it. Interesting, though. And, you know, this kills me when Bush talks about his legacy. And I saw an article the other day. I nearly choked. The article read something that, could Africa be Bush's legacy? That's some trumped up BS. In any case, even though they've scaled up fundings for AIDS overseas, the United States has simultaneously cut spending for domestic HIV prevention and care initiatives, even as HIV caseloads in black America have risen very, very sharply. U.S. policy treats AIDS as a foreign policy priority, but virtually ignores the epidemic among black citizens at home. What if black America were its own country? Interesting facts. Standing on its own, black America would constitute the world's 35th most populous country, but it would rank 16th in the world with the number of people living with HIV. A freestanding black America would rank 105th in worldwide life expectancy and 88th in infant mortality. And blacks in the U.S. have a lower life expectancy than do citizens of Algeria or the Dominican Republic or Sri Lanka. And outside of sub-Saharan Africa, only four countries have adult HIV prevalence as high as the conservative estimates for black America. And blacks represent about 1 in 8 Americans, but account for 1 in 2 people living with HIV in the U.S. And it goes on to point out other disparaging things regarding the care. It talks about black women, black men, the infection rates, this sort of thing. So in any case, the report says that the federal government is taking a fundamentally flawed approach toward the epidemic in black America by applying the prevention paradigm developed for concentrated epidemics, which focuses almost exclusively on high-risk groups. And this concentrated epidemic approach reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of the social networks in black America. And it goes on to discuss the various support, including the church. You know, we really should have a member of this organization on the show. I'm going to make a note and see if I can get a representative to come aboard. The Black AIDS Institute should be interesting. I'll make a note and see if we can set that up for next week. By the way, next week, oh yeah, here's the little note. Couple of interesting guests. Next Wednesday will be Madeline Urban, who will be the third in our series of gay fiction writers who write gay fiction. I have no idea if Madeline Urban is gay or not. I would expect that she's not, since we're in the previous guests we've talked about. There are a lot of heterosexual women who write this genre, so one would expect that she's not. But I'll tell you what, we'll ask her first thing this coming Wednesday evening, which will be August the 6th. And also, Amuka has moved up. Her date will be August the 7th, which will be this coming Thursday at 9 p.m. Now, if you don't know Amuka, all you have to go do is go to YouTube and type in Amuka, A-M-U-K-A, and you'll be presented with many videos. Amuka, this is her new name, but she's been around for a long, long time and is a very interesting guest, and one that Glenn has set up for us for this coming Thursday. By the way, did you hear about PG&E? They are going to give $250 million to keep marriage legal in California. That is exactly the same amount, by the way. That figure always sticks in my head. The same amount of money that Dell gave to the Bush coronation for the exclusive recrowning of George W. Bush and his second gala. In any case, it's interesting. PG, that's up Pacific, what is it, Gas and Electric. They're going to be giving $250,000 to keep marriage legal. It's going to go to California's vote no on Proposition 8. Company officials have indicated they would attempt to garner support from other companies to defeat the anti-gay measure. I'm sure the American Family Institute is keeping a close eye on this. By assembling, they're going to assemble a business advisory council on the matter. And Proposition 8 would amend the state's constitution, as we know, to bar marriage between same-sex couples. The director of Equality California, and this is the understatement of the year, we are thrilled to partner with PG&E, I'm sure. Also, AT&T and Wells Fargo Bank have donated money directly to Equality California. This is very interesting information. Proponents of the measure have also made major donations. And the LGBT groups, are, by the way, are still calling for the boycott of the Hyatt hotels, which we talked about a week or so ago. Those are in San Diego. The owner, Doug Manchester, poured thousands of dollars into the effort to pass the marriage ban. So here we have Hyatt Hotels versus PG&E. I wonder who can do without the other. Certainly, I don't think the Hyatt is in any position to say, disconnect my gas and electricity. Don't you love it? In any case, GOP strategist says, well, it's not likely that it's going to, you know, that we can do anything about PG&E because they have a monopoly in the entire market in California. And I can't just call PG&E and say, cut off my gas. Honey, you're completely out of gas as it stands. You might as well. Oh, Bob, I think we have a very short audio clip for this one. There's a, it's called the Out Awards. It's from the Commercial Closet Associations, and the awards are in for this year's Outstanding Nonprofit Campaign. And it's very short. It's a video. It runs 30 seconds, but I'll describe the scene. Bob can run the audio here in just a moment. Bob, let me see what that audio track is called so you can cue it up there. It's called Garden State Marriage. It came from New Jersey, Garden State, of course, and the PSA is just two women, dressed in, you know, just regular standard clothes, nothing outlandish. Two women standing next to each other having a conversation while facing the camera, and it won the Commercial Closet Association Award for this year. Bob, roll that clip, please. It's 30 seconds.
Hello, I'm married.
And I'm civil unionized.
I have all the legal protections and rights of a marriage provided by the state constitution.
I have those too.
I have insurance and pension benefits.
Me too.
Hospital visitation rights. Just last week my husband was in an accident. I felt so much better when I got to see for myself that he was okay.
The same thing happened to me. I told the nurse that my civil union allows me visitation. She wouldn't let me in or even tell me what happened.
You should upgrade to a marriage.
I think so.
And I've been civil unionized. Too funny. Yeah, I think you ought to upgrade your marriage. Oh, I do too. Very clever. Very clever. And well done. Well done, New Jersey Garden State marriage. There was another outdoor print and advertising campaign. An award went to BMW, of course, not from the Commercial Closet Associations for Awards for Outstanding Nonprofit Campaign. Obviously, BMW is not a nonprofit, but it's a billboard campaign that's going on in L.A., and the campaign consists of a beautiful image of a BMW car, and the text reads quite simply, hard top, firm bottom, it's so L.A. You just gotta love that. Oh, man, yep, it's looks like we're entering into the culture. We seem to be just about everywhere except the low-life, knuckle-dragging, highly paid, multimillionaire-paid right-wing hate speakers who continue to divide this country. In my estimation, all of them should be tried for treason. So, it's 10:34. I think it's about time we head over to the little gay bar across the street called the Paradise Dance Hall. This evening we have Jerry Bonham playing an absolutely fabulous set from the Trocadero in San Francisco. Fabulous, just fabulous. If you'd like to find out about Jerry, he's at jerrybonham.com. That's B-O-N-H-A-M, jerrybonham.com. So as we grab up our little umbrellas and our raincoats and our pocketbooks and all of the things we need, let's head over to the Paradise Dance Hall.
Across the alley was the Paradise Dance Hall. Evenings in spring, they'd open all the doors and windows and the music would come outside. Sometimes they'd turn out all the lights except for a large glass sphere that hung from the ceiling. It would turn slowly about and filter the dusk with delicate rainbow colors.
And there you have it. That was played live at the Trocadero in San Francisco. That particular set was called Groove at the Trocadero from Mr. Jerry Bonham. He's at jerrybonham.com. Absolutely flawless mixing. And well done, Jerry. Well done. I'm glad to have Jerry as part of the DJ team that does the Gay Bar Across the Street segments for us. Now, I have to mention just briefly, every once in a while all of us get a little bit discouraged and, you know, we get feeling kind of down and, you know, are we really making any difference? I know all of us do on this side of the conservative and progressive, both sides are, we're, those on this side sometimes feel that we may not be making any difference at all. I kind of felt that way this afternoon, and I must say that that having the Reverend Bob Galloway on the show this evening was certainly changed my feeling. It's people like that that make doing this show, and I'm sure the other shows on the Head On Radio Network, worthwhile. I need to let you know that my voice is a little scratchy, and Bob is rather John is not going to be running his show this evening, so there's not going to be a horn section this evening, and all Foxed Up will be in replay also, so I wanted to let you know that. Quickly to let you know also that next week we will have more of the series of gay fiction writers. We will have a Madeline Urban